Look at the Mysterious Universe, Season 28, Episode 16. Coming up on the show, we've got The Exorcism of Garkon, The Killing Blows of the E.T. Pugilists, and Bigfoot versus the Bot Boxes. I'm Benjamin Grundy, joining me is Aaron Wright.
I already know what the Bot Boxes are, so I have to ask, what are the Pugilists?
Pugilists. Boxes.
Oh, fighters. We've both got boxes then. Yeah,
fighters with the fists.
Right.
It's a pugilist. Psh, psh,
psh. Okay.
It's right. A Halloween-themed pugilism show.
How is boxing Halloween?
I don't freaking know. We do this every year where we're just like... Our entire show is Halloween, so why would we do a Halloween-themed show?
That is a good point.
Yeah. But I do have some AI-generated Halloween stories coming up. Because I was trying to find, you know, we used to cover, like, was it realghoststories.com
your
back
ghost
in the day?
Yeah.
And a lot of those websites are gone. They're just not around anymore. Because I was looking for just the most awful, cheesy, horrible, spooky Halloween ghost stories that we can make fun of.
Like origins of Who Was Phone.
Yeah, and then I just thought, why don't I use an AI content generator and just put in ridiculous terms like honky-tonk piano. You know, so I did this. I put in losing my virginity to a honky-tonk piano, and I generated one of the greatest AI Halloween stories of all time.
Are you serious? What could you possibly expect to get out of that?
A lot. About 7 minutes of content at the end of the show is what you'll get. It's amazing how good these things are now. Like, there's one called Jasper AI where... content writers use it. So if they're writing copy for their website or doing SEO stuff, you just type in a bunch of keywords and it just generates 1,000 words.
I want to start using it for the show notes.
Well, you can't tell that it's written by an AI for the most part.
Yeah.
I mean, for most generic things. You're never going to see AI articles on Mysterious Universe, by the way. I mean, we're never going to put them on our website. But for the most part, for very generic things, you can't tell. And I even saw one that was generated in the style of Stephen King the other day.
What do you mean? So you put in his name or something?
Just like you can with the AI artwork, you can say in the style of Greg Witkowski, for example, and it'll generate an image based on his style.
So what, it pulls obviously huge amounts of their work and then it must form data sets on that?
You can do the same thing. You can write in the style of Stephen King and it'll generate the content as if it's written by Stephen King. I saw one the other day. It was an entire novel that's generated by AI. And it was pretty good.
It's getting scary, Ben. It's actually getting quite uncomfortable, I think. In the past, we'd be like, hey, this is really cool. But losing the human edge, the human soul to, you know, content, it feels icky.
It's definitely wrong.
Yeah, it's wrong.
And I'll explain how wrong it is with 7 minutes of hot AI chaff. The end of the show. Hot AI Halloween chaff.
I think that's the first time I've ever heard that sentence uttered.
But today I'm going to be talking about Preston Dennett's new book. You know, he puts out these compilations called Not From Here, Selected UFO Articles. This is up to volume 4 and we've always covered them.
Yeah, they're great.
We've covered the first 3.
I love his work.
And we just pick and choose some of the interesting things in there. But he's got a whole selection of cases where people just beat the crap out of aliens.
Brilliant.
How good is that?
So they should. I mean, I thought about it because I'm going to go into, in the Plus extension, essentially this, what appears to be an ET Bigfoot controlled intergalactic war for mining operations on a certain ranch in Colorado, right? So we're going to go into that in the Plus extension. But I had this kind of epiphany. I was like, people actually have these invasions. They are home invasions. People wake up to find shadow people in their rooms. They wake up to find greys. You know, we should be attacking them.
Yeah.
Like, there's nothing that's consensual about this.
No.
We should be getting rid of them.
We need to fight back.
I think so.
Take control. Well, let's look at this. This is Not From Here, Volume 4 from Preston Dennett. And, yeah, Chapter 7. I skipped the first 6 chapters. What has he got here? He's got... UFO car lift cases. So, you know, you're driving along, your car starts to float off the road. He's got a bunch of those.
Where are my notes? Actually, the funny you should say that.
You got something like that coming up as well.
No, I didn't have it. It was from when I was covering all the stuff about Rex Gilroy, right? And Rex Gilroy, in that newsletter that he was publishing, he was obviously collecting stories from people who have had weird experiences in remote locations in Australia. And there were 2 that really stood out, which I didn't get a chance to mention. But I'll just briefly mention them here because they seem to happen more often than you realize. One is that there were a group of young men that claimed that they were driving along an isolated highway somewhere like the Nullarbor Plain or something like that, a very, very isolated location in Australia. Light is seen in the distance, a light comes over, picks up their car, And then because I had such a long way to go, it would have taken them 2 or 3 hours to get to the next location. All of a sudden, the car comes back down the ground and they're at their location. It was like they, and nothing seemed different. It just felt like they were moving through the air, but it happened so rapidly that they arrived. And that was fine, right? No, nothing bad seemed to happen. I think there was some suggestion of a regression, but nothing bad happened. The best story was, though, is a group of Aboriginal guys had contacted either, I don't know if it was Don Boyd or Rex Gilroy, but they had claimed that they had witnessed a group of, I don't know if it was an opposing tribe or something, but they had seen some light that was hovering over their property and they were freaked out by it. So they ran into a car, they climbed into a car, and the UFO came down, picked up the car and stole it.
Great.
And never came back.
Well, they were in it?
Well, they were in it.
So it stole them as well?
It stole them as well.
And like, so we've just got two missing people now.
Yeah. It's just, it's wild, this story. And like, obviously they are obviously very unconventional, but from what you're mentioning, it seems like these stories happen more frequently than you'd imagine.
Well, he's got, a bunch of them. And then I crashed into a UFO as one of the other chapters.
Oh, brilliant.
Where you're just driving along and you have a head-on collision with something that you can't see.
Yeah.
And it's a craft apparently parked on the highway. ETs and fertilizer.
What do you mean fertilizer?
This is why I skipped it. This is why I skipped all these. UFO stealing fertilizer. I don't know. I don't know how else to explain it. There's nothing more exciting than that. Those damn UFOs, which is UFOs.
Stealing water from dams.
Stealing water from dams. Yep. Yep. My God.
Why? I like those stories.
So
I don't see why you're so, disappointed
and
by
then
them.
Chapter 7, I punched a gray in the face. So which one am I going to do?
Okay, fair enough. Yeah, I'll give you that one.
And he says, look, as a general rule, if you're visited by grey ETs, you're paralyzed. You can't move. Maybe you can move your eyeballs and the entities will communicate with you. Don't worry, we're not going to hurt you. Come with us. Preston says this is perhaps the most single common phrase that the ETs say. And he says, for every rule, however, there are exceptions and there are cases where people have no fear and they're given some freedom of movement in these abduction scenarios. And in some rare outlying cases, he says, witnesses are able to break free from their paralysis and sometimes attack. So the most famous example, everyone knows this one, Travis Walton from 1975, one of the most famous alien abduction cases of all time. When he first woke up on the table, he actually was able to move. He flailed about and he swung his arms wildly and he actually hit one of the entities. Now, he said when he made contact with it, it's felt spongy.
Oh, I do recall that.
He says, the one I touched felt soft through the cloth of its garment. The muscles of its puny physique yielded with a sponginess that was more like fat than sinew. The creature was light and had fallen back easily. Now, it's interesting to bring up that description because quite a few of these witnesses describe that same thing, that they feel soft, they feel spongy. There's a case from MUFON's files. This is from a recent one from April the 5th back in 2017. 4 a.m., this young man from Del Valle in Texas, he's woken up by his dogs going bananas. And he gets up, he checks the house, he thinks there's an intruder inside. And he goes into the room where his mom and her boyfriend's sleeping. And he claims he sees two greys about 6 feet tall standing by the beds. And at the same time, another grey, this one just under 7 feet tall, comes floating in through the window. Now, he says his first reaction is to grab the nearest one, flip him, and punch him in the head. He says, the other figure grabbed me. He said, I turned and swung at it and punched it in the head. He said, as soon as I looked to the third figure, it was floating back out the window. Both my mum and her boyfriend started to float up, and I blacked out. He said, I woke up in the bed sweating, panting heavily. My fists were red and in pain, and the dogs were still going bananas. So his mom still got abducted, but he got a few shots in.
I recall a story years and years ago of a guy that described, and I think it was from like one of those forums above Top Secret, or maybe it was like one of those Your Ghost Story places, I can't remember. But there was a guy that claimed that he woke up to a weird light outside his bedroom. And because it was bright, like he thought it was the neighbors that had their high beams on their vehicle coming through. He's like, what are they doing? And he was looking up at this bright light when all of a sudden he realized he could hear, and he was looking off to his left and he could hear this kind of soft breathing to his right. And of course, you know, you've just woken up and you're trying to work out what's going on. And he turned and he said that there was a gray, like literally a typical gray next to the bed. And he grabbed it, like instinctually, he grabbed it and he started squeezing its throat. And he claims that as he squeezed its throat, it kind of made a weird like dog toy squeaking noise. And then white goop fluid came out of its mouth. And then it just dematerialized.
So it made the little squeaky noise.
And then, it was like, and then all of a sudden it just dematerialized.
That's, I want to do that one day to one of these little fuckers. Just want to grab its
neck. That's the thing though. In comparison to us as human beings, the only thing they have over us is the ability to paralyze us because we're so much bigger and stronger than
them. Oh, and all the high technology and
the ability to
travel as fast as the speed of sound.
No, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about when you wake up in your bedroom to find them.
Just one-on-one, like in the octagon.
Exactly, yeah.
It'd be pretty easy to beat a grey.
Just kick its face off.
That's right. October the 17th, 2016, we've got a MUFON field investigator, Ben Moss, who was speaking to the witness, Sarah, this young woman from Virginia. She was alone in bed. It was around 4 a.m. Her husband had just left for work, and she's woken up by strange shuffling footsteps coming from the back of the house. Now, obviously, she thinks this might be an intruder, but she's had strange encounters in the past, so another part of her mind is going, it's them.
Them, yeah.
Slowly, the footsteps come closer. She's laying motionless in bed, and suddenly the intruder's in the room. She feels three small figures grab her and try to pull her from the bed. She immediately starts to fight back. She said, it was extremely hard for me to get my right arm free, but I did and started fighting and punching them as hard as I could. Now, she said she made contact with the bottom of her fist on one of them a few times, and listen to how she described it. She says it felt almost like I was hitting a rubbery tire-like material, not as dense as a tire was. It was like a mix of flesh and rubber. And it kind of brings to mind, you know, Travis Walton saying that it's spongy. They're spongy. She said they suddenly let me go and I got my feet under me. Anyway, she sat back in the bed, terrified, angry. A few seconds pass. She blacks out. The next thing she knows, her alarm's going off to get ready for work. And she's just aching all over. And when she sees that the room has all this stuff knocked over, memories come back of what actually happened that night. Again, she wasn't able to prevent anything from happening. She still claims that she was taken. She claims she got hypnosis soon after this, and there was a full-blown abduction that occurred that night. There's a classic case, which we've mentioned on the show before, from Don Worley and Ann Druffel. Two UFO investigators, they spoke to this witness, Patsy Wingate of Knoxville, Tennessee. She had a bunch of encounters throughout her life, but one winter evening in 1985, she woke up in the middle of the night. She sees three greys enter her bedroom, and she's pregnant at the time. She's mentally shouting, "Leave me alone," but they continue to advance. Now, Patsy becomes enraged. She jumps out of the bed, runs toward them, grabs the one, similar to your story, grabs the one in the center who's slightly taller, and without thinking, she squeezes its neck.
Yeah, there you go.
And to her astonishment, it doesn't make a squeaky toy noise and goo comes out. The neck literally snaps over, and the head, because the head's so heavy, it just folds backwards.
Does it go boy, boy, boy?
Yeah, it just folds backwards, just hanging there, and she hears the sound of the neck snapping. Now, she's horrified. She didn't mean to kill the thing. She looks over and she sees the other two entities, like the looks on their faces, the eyes raise ever so slightly as if what the hell is going on?
Kill them too.
They scoop up their now neck-snapped companion and escape through the wall, and she survives the night. She doesn't get taken that night.
That's the weird element of these cases though, isn't it? It's like they're ethereal, but they're physical at the same time. I mean, they're able to pass through a wall, and yet at the same time, she's capable of snapping its neck.
There's another one from Louisiana from this sports instructor. His name's Tim. I don't know if it's a pseudonym. But around the age of 20, he started having all these horrible alien dreams, right? And then he started to wake up in them and realize they weren't dreams. He was actually lucid and it was happening. On one occasion, at first he thought it was a dream. He was restrained on a table, you know, the usual abduction scenario. But somehow he got loose, and it's this great, it's like a boxing movie where he actually is approached by one of these greys walking around, and he just like just gives it a swift jab to the head, and it just crumples like he's killed it. And he says the way he described hitting it, its face felt like it was like you're punching a beanbag. And then all of them started to appear out of nowhere, like all these little 3 foot greys. And it's kind of a funny thing because he's a 6 foot tall guy and they're only 3.5 feet tall. So it's like you're fighting a bunch of children on a UFO, just like bam, bam, bam. Just like if you got a quick enough jab, you could probably take out five or six of them before they swarm you. And he says that's what happened. He took out a bunch of them, just like nice, clean, sharp jabs to the face, and they just crumpled down like they're dead. And the last thing he remembers is one of them coming towards him, like a taller one with like its fingers have claws, and he sees the eyes like right up to his face, then he blacks out. It's like it took control of his mind and took control of the situation. There's a bunch of other encounters. I just like to mention these because they're creepy. It's a Halloween show.
It still doesn't beat the best story, though, of the guy that used a samurai sword to cut a grey in half.
No. Well,
I mean, that's the coup de grace of alien.
That is the greatest story of all time, which we completely debunked when we covered it on the show. Completely debunked that story.
We'll just ignore that part.
I wanted to mention this because the response from Preston is, and I love Preston's work, but it's the lamest thing you could ever write.
How so? Why do you say that?
He says, "This was not an easy chapter to write. As someone who's convinced that most ETs do not mean us harm, cases like these provide a literally painful reminder that humans are a hostile species."
Oh, I disagree. Yeah, no.
"And I can say with complete honesty that nobody has ever told me that they were punched in the face by an alien." It's like, dude.
They stick probes up people's backside.
They're rendering you paralyzed, taking you against your will.
Impregnating you.
Doing God knows what to you in these horrible exams, these experiments, and then you're damaged by it. That's assault. That's way worse than being punched in the face. Anyway, so that's his view on it. But he had this great chapter on the hitchhikers, and that's another, I guess, Halloween-themed trope of picking up the haunted hitchhiker.
Oh, yes. Yeah, of course it is.
You know,
yeah.
you pull over, you give someone a lift, and then you've got a dead woman in the back of your car.
Well, you commonly hear those stories, like you heard it after the Fukushima tsunami. You know, it was described as taxi drivers would drive along and pick up people that were wet, you know, and that kind of thing, like these stories. Also, it happened after the Boxing Day tsunami throughout, you know, Thailand and those areas as well.
There's a bunch of great cases here. There's one from Virgil Atkinson. He's a military officer from Port Huname, Naval Base in California. He says, "Look, I swear to you, what I'm about to share is the truth." He had his first encounter back in 1956. He had met this girl in Santa Monica, California, and he was driving with her to the naval base that he was stationed at when they saw two young sailors hitchhiking, just, you know, young guys with their thumbs out. And being in the military, he wanted to pick them up. So he pulls over and he gives them a lift. Now they get in the back of the car and he's immediately shocked by their appearance because they look like kids. They look like 13, 14-year-old, maximum 15 years old. And he's really suspicious that they're actually sailors. Now, he asks them where they're heading, and they say the Coos Head Naval Facility in Charleston, Oregon. Now, he hadn't heard of the facility. Apparently, it was a newly commissioned one. So a few miles down the road, he arrives at his turnoff, and he pulls over to let them out. And after he lets the sailors out, he keeps driving. He's thinking, that's weird. They were just like kids. So bizarre. Anyway, he gets back on the road and this strange large light starts following his car. And he keeps driving and looking back in his mirror and his girlfriend's freaking out. He wants to stop, but his girlfriend's so scared. She's like lying on the floor of the car saying, "Keep going, keep going, keep going." And as they approach the lights of the next town, the object suddenly ascends at a 45-degree angle and disappears into the sky. Now, he calls the police and reports the sighting, and he's certain that those sailors that he picked up had something to do with it. They were connected in some way because it was just so bizarre that they were like kids. Like they had a costume, but it just didn't match. It's like they knew they had to look like sailors.
Yeah, but they didn't get it quite right.
They didn't realize that they needed to look older. So 1 year later, Atkinson, by some weird coincidence, he gets assigned to that Coos Bay facility, the same facility that those sailors that he picked up said that they were going to. Now, he was stationed there just from 1957 to 1959 before he was transferred. But while he was at this base, he had another encounter. Early one morning, he claims he woke up to find himself lying on a waist-high gurney. And he's surrounded by four men wearing blue jumpsuits. Not aliens, four men. Now, he had no idea how he had gotten there. He had no idea what's happening. He claims that his head was resting on some kind of weird pillow that was able to suck in his thoughts and then transmit it on a kind of computer screen. Now, remember, this is 1957. So what does the average guy know about a computer screen? He claims it's this large flat screen and it's showing his thoughts on there. He said one of the men questioned me about the spinning gyro and what I understood about it. And he's like, spinning gyro? And instantly this helicopter? Image, well, this image appears on the screen. And he says all of a sudden he didn't feel so relaxed and he actually tried to stop cooperating with them. Like he wasn't meant to give them this information. Now, these men, they look at each other and he senses that the session's over. Doesn't know what the hell's just happened. The next thing he remembers, he's waking up in his bunk wondering what the hell that was. Now, he didn't mention this encounter to anyone because he didn't want to appear unstable because it would probably be detrimental to his career. So he didn't know what to make of this incident, this strange memory or thought device pulling out of his head some kind of spinning gyro-like machine. And he's like, where did that thought even come from? I didn't know that was in my head. Anyway, he spent the next 30 years in naval service working on various projects. He retired in 1988. And after he retired, he found himself with this drive to make things, like invent something. And specifically, he felt in his mind that he needed to create an engine, a motor. And so this idea was just floating around all the time in his subconscious for years. And when he retired, he started to experiment. Like he would just get odds and ends from around the house and try and, you know, tape things together, get the soldering iron out and try and make something. And he wasn't exactly certain how to do it. But eventually, after weeks and weeks and weeks and all this trial and error, he started to create an engine. He started to create a motor. Now, while he was in the process of this and testing this thing out and figuring out how it actually worked, and he was doing all of this in his workshop at home, one day this well-dressed, middle-aged man, human-looking guy, just waltzes into his backyard.
It was like a 12-year-old in a suit?
No, he's just, you know, average-looking guy, well-dressed, so we can assume a suit. And Atkinson walks out of his workshop and goes to greet this guy. And he says, look, I said hello to him and whether there's something I could help him with. And he said all this guy did was look at him. And for some reason, Atkinson said that he knew immediately that the guy had something to do with computers. He doesn't elaborate how he knew that.
No, but you do hear of that uncanny knowing from a lot of people that have had these interactions.
He just had this weird understanding that this was a guy involved with something super technical. And as they're standing facing each other, immediately his thoughts go all the way back to that encounter in 1958 at that naval facility when he was, you know, on the gurney surrounded by these men. And without saying another word, this strange man just smiles and points at his workshop door. And Atkinson gets the feeling that he knows exactly what I'm working on. This stranger turns about face and walks off his property. He never sees him again. Now, since that time at the Coos Head Naval Base, he claims he's obtained United States patents for a vehicle that operates using harmonics. He claims that he's recently invented a working model of the world's first hybrid boat motor that runs on sound waves. It's got a mechanical propeller. Actually, it has no mechanical propeller, he says. It just works on acoustics. And he's convinced that something was embedded into his brain in 1956 to push him to create all these things by these entities.
So they uploaded some schematic into his head?
Well, it's like he said when those guys in the blue outfits were scanning his brain and they saw that spinning thing on the screen, he said there was a moment where they looked at each other and there was an acknowledgement of, oh, crap, why has this guy got something in his head? There was this moment of, what is this? So he thinks it may be those weird children that he picked up, the 13-year-olds or whatever, that put something in his head. And there's actually more to that initial encounter than he remembers.
Okay.
There's another one from Leo Sprinkle. This goes back to October in 1967. There's a Norman C. driving to his home near Lakewood, Colorado. He's flagged down by a strange man. He thinks it's a hitchhiker. This guy's 6 feet tall. He's got a forked goatee. He's wearing a jacket with four gold bars on each shoulder. Like a kind of military.
Like an insignia?
Like a military shoulder pads or something. And Norman stops and this guy starts to communicate telepathically with him, asking where the North Star was and what date it is, quote, in your primitive time. Now, the witness, Norman, he's smoking a cigarette and the hitchhiker is apparently puzzled by it and asks what it is. He says, oh, it's called a cigarette. And this guy says, oh, one of your vices. The man also asked about the car and he called it a primitive mode of transportation. This guy's just a jerk. He's like, if he's an alien, he's a bit of a jerk. And at this point, Norman asked who the man was and where he came from. He says, I cannot tell you now, but my colleagues and I will return. He steps back 4 feet from the car, disappears. Norman looks up, sees a giant red object the size of a football field that flies away at great speed. And I'm just like,
what the hell is going on?
What's the point of this? What's the point of this encounter? He's not even hitchhiking. Hitchhiking is not a hitchhiking encounter. Because hitchhiking, you need to go somewhere. This is just flagging someone down, insulting them, and then being weird about it.
Maybe there's a species of ETs that do exactly that, though. That's all they do.
Yeah, that's their modus operandi.
Flag you down, insult you, and then leave.
Yeah, tell you your car's shit and you should give up smoking. And then another classic, the March of 1973 classic with 20-year-old Frank Bales. He was visiting Mount St. Helens in Washington State, and he was kind of looking for a canoeing trip. He was looking for a suitable location for a future trip. He parked his car. He decides to climb up the slopes of the mountain, get a better view. But shortly after beginning the hike, he had this strange fear come over him and he was just terrified for some reason. And he's wondering why, like, what is going on? Why am I feeling this way? And then suddenly visions of St. Helens erupting start flashing through his mind. He gets this really strong premonition of this volcanic explosion. When did St. Helens erupt?
Was it 80
something?
Let me have a look.
Google that. But this is 1973, so he's a bit ahead of time. He races back to his car and he's just terrified by this vision. He decides to go home. He just,
1980.
Okay. So he's 7 years early. He starts driving down the curving mountain road thinking that was too weird. I've got to get out of here. And coming around a corner, he sees two figures. It's a man and a woman. They're dressed in dirty white robes standing alongside the road. And he thinks they might be Hare Krishnas or something. And it's odd that they're so far away from town. Like they're in the middle of the wilderness on Mount St. Helens. This is weird. So he pulls over and he gets out of the car and he's like, I've got to help these guys out. They're in the middle of nowhere. And he approaches them and realizes that they're close to 10 feet tall. And he asks them if they want to ride to town. And it's a woman and a man, these giant people. The woman turns to the man and says, I thought we were supposed to meet someone here. The man replies that Frank was the contact they're waiting for. And suddenly another car drives up and stops asking Frank if he's all right. Like, is there anything wrong with your car? Frank suddenly realizes that the other guy in this other car can't see these 10-foot tall freaks standing on the side of the road.
So does that mean he's hallucinating or are they hiding from?
Well, he doesn't know what's going on. So he just says to the other guy in the car, oh, it's fine. I'm just, you know, checking out the scenery, just looking at the view. And the guy's like, okay, see you later. He drives off. Now, Frank's can still see these 10-foot tall people in their weird white robes. And he says, look, do you want a lift? Now, he's driving a tiny Volkswagen Beetle. Right.
These things are 10 foot.
They're 10 feet tall. Like you would have trouble getting into a Volkswagen Beetle.
Yeah, I wouldn't get in.
And as soon as he says that, he's like, oh crap, they're not gonna fit. Almost as if reading his mind, the tall 10 foot tall man says, we'll fit fine, don't worry. And then like Super Mario getting hit by a Goomba. They start
getting the sound effect.
Do, and they start shrinking. And they climb into the back seat. And he's like, all right. Now, he's spaced out by this. So the first thing he does when he starts driving is he pulls out a beer and just starts drinking because he's like, this is crazy. I gotta get some booze. So he's drinking his beer, driving his Volkswagen Beetle with these weird shrinking couple in the back seat.
Try explaining that if you get pulled over.
And he wonders if they might be angels or something. And he turns around to examine them and he looks closely at their fingers. They got 6 fingers. On their hands.
Right, so there's something off. I mean, apart from the fact that they've just shrunk.
Well, remember when we did a couple of Giants episodes years ago? That was one of the standout things from history, from historical records, is that
yes.
Giants had an extra finger.
Mm-hmm.
There's all sorts of various cultures mentioned this extra finger. And these guys are 10 feet tall. So an interesting correlation. But they actually, the male figure says, turn around and watch the road. And Frank assures, he's like, oh, don't worry, I'm a really good driver. And he continues to drink his beer. And the man says, what is that you're drinking? He's like, beer. The guy says, alcohol, that's poison, and it's going to cause a lot of problems in your life.
They're always such buzzkills, though, aren't they? Don't smoke, don't drink. I mean, come on.
Well, it's like he didn't have any other options. You were standing on the side of a mountain with your 10-foot-tall goofy girlfriend. Your robes are covered in dirt. What are you going to do? So Frank becomes increasingly curious, obviously, and he starts to think, what the hell? Are these guys aliens? Are they angels? What's going on? How did they shrink?
They're not angels.
He looks at them again, and they both look like humans. They just look perfectly human. They've both got long brown hair. They appear to be in their early 30s. And Frank tells them about his vision of Mount St. Helens exploding. Now, the man says that Frank is correct and that the mountain will explode in 1980. He's told by this man that 60 to 70 people will die on the mountain when it erupts, which was turned out to be accurate. Now, thoroughly intrigued, Frank asks them flat out, okay, who are you guys? What is going on? Now, the woman turns to the man in the back seat and says, should we tell him who we are? No, the man answers. And he turns to Frank and says, we're watchers. Okay, well, what's your names? He asks. My name is Gurusiamine.
Of course it is. Of course it is.
And the woman says, my name is Isu. It's easy to remember. Just think about it this way. Say Isu, and you'll remember it forever. Now, strangely, Frank completely forgot their names and didn't remember them until 33 years later when he had a dream about the encounter and everything came rushing back. So he wanted to ask them more questions, but for some reason on the rest of the journey, he couldn't talk. It's like some external force was making him mute. And about 10 miles outside of Toledo, Washington, Gurusiamine said, pull over here. When we get out, don't look back. So Frank obliges. He pulls over and lets them out and pulls back onto the highway. And of course, he looks back. Now, when he looks back, he watches and he claims these two guys go, pew, pew, pew. And they start growing until they're 10 feet tall again. And then they promptly disappear.
Did they eat a mushroom beforehand?
To this day, he believes he gave a ride to two extraterrestrials. Classic Halloween hitchhiker alien story.
Where's your soundboard?
It's retired.
We need to scream
retired
at the end of that.
Soundboard. It's retired. I need to build a new one. This is a great one from Canada this time. October 18th, 1974. Ed Moana Taos. What kind of a name's Ed Moana?
It's like, what? Hawaiian?
Ed Moana? Well, if your name's Moana, why are you putting Ed on the front of it? Moana's like a nice name. That's a nice Disney name.
She's your judgmental.
Why are you putting Ed on the front of your name?
Because that's her name.
That's a man's name.
It's not her fault.
That's short for Edward.
Well, clearly Ed Moana is a woman's name.
Well, it's weird. Ed Moana.
Okay. Well, now we've got through your Halloween judgment episode.
Ed Moana and Nuria. Ugh. What was that? Nuria Hansen, they're driving on the highway at the summit of Steamboat Mountain in British Columbia, and they see two strange lights. One appears to be just resting on the side of the mountain, this weird light. But the other, which is three times the size of the moon, they claim, starts flying towards them and kind of darts up in the sky and hovers over their car. Now, when they look closer, it kind of looks like a giant derby hat made of silver with portholes in the bit on top. Now, they continue driving, just going, what the hell is this thing? Is this a flying saucer? But they need to concentrate on the road because the weather is really bad. It's foggy. The road is actually icy. And Ed Moana reports something strange happens to her car. She claims that something starts to control it. And it's moving them along the highway, but only at 25 miles per hour. Now, it's then that they notice this bright cloud-like object is actually still hovering over their car. It's like directly above them. Now, it remains there for the rest of this trip. And she also notices that her fuel gauge never moves. It's like They're not even using gas. So they're going 25 miles per hour on this frozen highway. Eventually, they stop at a lodge at Muncho Lake. Now, the lodge is closed, but their approach suddenly out of nowhere. They don't see where he comes from. This young man with dark hair and a beard. Now, obviously, it's cold. It's below zero, right? It's like -2 degrees Celsius or something out there. And this man walks up to them. He's wearing simply a T-shirt. He's got just loose pants on and your basic pair of shoes. Like, he should be turning blue. And he looks fine. He asks them for a ride, but the women decline. And the main reason they decline is they point to the back of their car and it's just full of stuff. Like, they've got suitcases and they've got all these different bits of luggage, skis and whatever. Just their whole car is full. The only spare seats is the driver's seat and the passenger seat. Despite this, this stranger in the middle of nowhere somehow convinces them to give him a ride. It's like, where's he going to sit? He ends up sitting on Nuria's lap in the front passenger seat.
That's odd.
Now, yeah, she's, and they don't think it's weird. They're just like tricked by this guy somehow. They're hypnotized by him. And so he's sitting on her lap as they continue down the highway. And at one point it strikes them, what the hell are we doing? Why is this guy sitting on my lap? What is going on? But Nuria realizes this stranger feels weirdly weightless.
Oh.
And she says to him, oh, this is weird. You feel really, really light. Like, I can't actually feel you sitting on my lap. What is going on? And he's just like, gaga block block.
Does the weight suddenly increase? They turn a knob somewhere to adjust the gravity.
He just mumbles something vague and they can't quite understand him. Now, Edmoana, who's driving, she looks over and she sees that, yeah, he's sitting on Nuria's lap, but he's hovering about an inch above her legs, which is why she can't feel anything, which is the most polite way to sit on a woman's lap in the passenger seat of a car, I think, if you're ever going to do it. And many of us have, let's face it. Many of us have taken that position.
Teenagers.
At one point, Edmoana asks this stranger's name. You think they would do that earlier. And he stares deeply into her eyes and replies, Gordon. Not a very exotic alien name.
No.
Maybe
just Gordon.
It's not Ed Gordon, is it? It's just Gordon. Don't put an Ed at the front of your name. Both women felt he looked slightly familiar, but couldn't place him. They continued the drive and stopped for the evening at a hotel in northern British Columbia. And as they all stepped out of the car, Gordon inexplicably vanished. No idea where he went. They looked all over. They called his name. Now, when they checked the tracks around the car, there was no footprints leading away from the car. So they just no idea what happened. So inside the hotel, they actually found another truck driver. This truck driver comes up to them and he's like, how are you even here? How did you even get here? And they're like, we drove. He's like, that's impossible. That's absolutely impossible. He had just come 165 miles from Steamboat Mountain. And he said the road conditions on the route that they took were impossible to pass. There's no way you could have driven that with just, you know, your normal car and your normal tires and everything. Now, the strangeness continued the next morning. They continued their trip. Again, they see this strange glowing cloud-like object hovering over their car. And it's a blizzard now. It's a full-on blizzard. But the road in front of them is dry and free of snow. And at some point during their trip, eventually their car mysteriously fails, like the engine fails. Like this whole trope, two mysterious men show up, seem to know all about the women, and help them restart the car. They end up driving up into Alaska to Edmoana's home in Anchorage. Only then, they said, the glowing cloud-like object above their car disappeared. And later, as they're thinking about this strange journey, Edmoana realizes that that strange disappearing hitchhiker, now that she thinks about it, really looked like her late husband.
What?
From years ago, like before they met, he was just a really young version of her dead husband.
So did it like tap into her thought patterns and mimic that?
Yeah,
or something?
I don't know. It's super weird. After reviewing the entire journey, they thought, okay, he was either an angel or an ET. And they ended up writing this up and it came out in Fate magazine back in 1977 under the title The UFOs That Led Us Home.
See, this is the contact phenomenon. It's like that movie with Jodie Foster, Contact, where the aliens show herself or show themselves as her father. It's the I reckon where they got that is from these old stories, because there's so many stories of where people describe interacting sometimes with ETs that look like deceased loved ones. Mm.
Yeah, it's a nice trick. But, yeah. Well, I mean, what's the point? Did they have missing time? Is there something about the trip that they can't remember? Why are these entities interacting with these two women? Why did he even need to sit in the car on her lap?
Probably because ETs are just so ridiculously out of touch that they either abduct people, you know, without obviously any consideration for them, mm-hmm. or they're just like, let's learn how to interact with humans, and they come down for a little bit of a sightseeing trip, and then they're out of here.
A more recent one here from July the 25th, 2001, Irina and her father were driving near the town of Mishor. This is along the southern coast of Crimea in Ukraine. They had just stopped to pick up some food and water, and they see this handsome young man hitchhiking along the highway. Now, Irina, she's mesmerized by his perfectly proportioned features. Mm-hmm. We know what this guy's mm-hmm. all about, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. He's tall. He's Pleiadians. Blonde. He's very buff, very attractive.
Space Fabio.
He's like a melt-in-your-mouth hitchhiker. And Irina starts begging her father to give this hitchhiker a ride. Like, please, father, please pick him up, please. Amazingly, he pulls over. The man sits in the back seat and they continue their trip. And along the way, they're looking in the rearview mirror and they can see he's acting super weird. He's holding and this is going to link to your stories coming up. He's holding a strange box-shaped device and he's mumbling to himself. He's like, and Irina's father's like, okay, this is too weird. This guy's like a psychopath or he's a serial killer. He just pulls over and tells the guy to get out. Instead of getting out, the man grabs Irina's hair, pulls her head back from the front and presses this box-like device against her back. Immediately, both her and her father are paralyzed, completely weak, completely dazed. The hitchhiker gets out of the car, sits down on a log and starts speaking into the black box in a language they don't understand.
Well, they're still paralyzed in the car.
And yeah, they're just frozen there. They can only move their eyeballs. Now, they're terrified. They want to leave. They want to get the hell out of there, obviously, but they're still unable to move. This strange guy gets back into the car and the car starts driving itself. He's just sitting in the back seat. The car keeps going. They both notice a white glowing light surrounding the car, they claim. And after traveling along the highway, the car stops by itself near an abandoned gas station. The hitchhiker again gets out of the car and starts picking up plants from the ground.
Oh, that's unusual.
He then approaches the car and, speaking in Russian, says thank you, and then disappears into a beam of light which turns green as it arcs over the front of the vehicle, and then both Irina and her father lose consciousness. They wake up, it's the next morning, and the only extra detail we get from this story is apparently Irina noticed that her eyes, which had been brown since birth, were now inexplicably green in color. Great story. 10 out of 10. I like your face. You're just like, what is going on? It's just like, I thought on Halloween we were supposed to do spooky stories, not shit stories. Okay, let me try and
to politely go, that was shit.
Look, I'm working with limited material today, okay? When it's getting to the end of the day and I'm putting story ideas into an AI generator, you know it's been a tough day for research. So I want to mention this one because it links, I think, to the Virginia case, which we heard from James Fox a couple of weeks ago. This is June the 12th, 2003, outside of Limeira in Sao Paulo in Brazil, 6:20 a.m., and it's Mr. Zimmerman who had left for work. He had just passed through the toll gate on the highway, and he sees this strange-looking figure hitchhiking on the side of the road. Now, he doesn't want to pick this guy up. He's like, it's risky to pick up strangers. I got to get to work. I don't have time to pick this guy up. But for some reason, he feels himself indicating and pulling over to the side of the road. And he's like, what am I doing?
Like he's being controlled.
Yeah. And the figure approaches. And again, Zimmerman surprises himself by rolling down the window to talk to the guy. Now, he can now see that this figure has large cat-like eyes, a small nose, a bald head, and is exuding a very, very powerful sulfuric odor.
Oh.
It's overpowering. This strange entity points toward the city ahead of them, which is where he's heading, and he gets in the car. Zimmerman can't do anything about it. He starts driving. He's completely overcome by this stench this thing's giving off. And he looks over at this thing. He sees this man is 5 feet tall, extremely pale, and is wearing this strange, tight-fitting outfit with weird, thick-soled shoes. And he's like, where do you want to go? And this thing just keeps pointing ahead. Doesn't say a word.
Doesn't say anything.
He's like, what's your name? This thing doesn't answer. And Zimmerman is shocked to see its eyes turn inky black. And he's really scared now. He's really frightened. He continues driving down the highway. And then this man in the passenger seat just starts going,
what, like a frog?
Starts croaking at him as he's driving. He looks more closely. He notices other odd details. The man's hand has 6 fingers, has black pointed fingernails, and his skin is slick with oil.
Oh, you're right. Like the beings that were described by James Fox.
Yeah. Now, but despite all this, he keeps trying to make small talk.
It's all awkward. So what else are you going to do?
Ask him if he's seen the football. What's the weather going to be like today? This weird guy just is silent the entire time. And after each question, its eyes would turn black. So when they finally reached the town of Piracicaba, where they were going, Zimmerman felt compelled again to stop the car. He feels himself pulling the car over. This strange man exits the vehicle, smiles at Zimmerman, crosses the road in front of him, and disappears into the bushes. Zimmerman drives off. He just had a severe headache after that. Like, yeah, he didn't die in hospital or anything.
It's odd, though, when you hear these stories. Like, it's like, what they just somehow get control of a car or get control of a person driving a car, and then they drive them for a certain distance, and then they always just wander off into the bushes. Like, what?
That's if where they parked their ship.
If there's a ship waiting there, why doesn't the ship just come over to you? Like, why are you getting into a craft? Like, surely you can traverse space. Why do you not have a remote control for your craft?
It's like, you know, when you travel to Cambodia, yes, I could get a taxi to go where I need to go, or I could take the fun route, which is a rickshaw. I get to get in the rickshaw with a local guy. You get to have a weird local conversation. You get to see the sights, smell the smells, hear the sounds. Like, it's more visceral to get in local transport. Like, you don't want to get in the air-conditioned bus to take you where you want to go. You want to get in the rickshaw and be with the people. That's what this alien's doing, don't you think?
That's anyway. Shit too. Sorry.
Yeah, I know. I know. Oh, none of these stories are very good. The next one's from OB, and this is actually a friend of a friend of a friend of Preston's, and we'll just call him Owen instead of OB. He was driving near Salisbury, Virginia, back in 2004. Sees a man alongside the highway, and he's wearing a thin top coat. And it's a freezing cold day, so he pulls over to give this guy a ride.
That's nice.
Yeah, it is just absolutely freezing. This guy, again, appears young, very handsome. He's got blonde hair. He climbs into the car and immediately says, "Your van is very hot." And complains several times. Like, he keeps driving. He's like, "Your van, it is very hot in here.
What do you want me to do?"
Dude, it's like 0 degrees. It's so cold outside. What's wrong with it? He just says, "Why don't you take your jacket off? Like, why don't you take your overcoat off?" "Okay," the man says. He pulls his coat off and to reveal that he's completely nude underneath. It's just like rippled abs, just hot Pleiadian nude body underneath. And Owen's shocked. He asks the man where he's from. The guy goes, Venice. And he's like, Venice, California? And he's like, "Oh, yeah, that's right, Venice, California." So he says this man has a strange tone in his voice that's difficult to describe. And immediately he just starts ranting about Earth governments and how they're taking the sides of corporations instead of the people.
Well, he's
and
right.
They're going to cause a financial collapse. And
yes,
there's going to be all this totalitarian control.
Yes.
Eventually, people are going to be forced to take all these vaccines. And this is back yes. in 2004.
That's insane. If that story is true.
This nude Palladian in the backseat of this guy's van reveals the future 16 years of humanity. And Owen's just like, what the hell is going on? He takes a closer look at this guy. His face does look slightly different. He's got abnormally large, bright blue eyes, long, very thin blonde hair, just slightly different to a normal human. And he starts to wonder, is this guy some kind of alien? What is going on here? And as soon as he has that thought,
No.
The man's like, I am from Venice, California, and you need to pull over right now.
Yeah, it's like it's reading his thoughts.
So he pulls over. The guy gets out and says, don't tell anyone about what I told you.
And it ends up getting published in a book.
And he drops him off near Fairground Road. Now, Owen later heard that a couple claimed to have been abducted in a UFO on that very road.
By a hot, naked Pleiadian.
Yes. Now, he also claims weeks later, he was driving with his wife along that same stretch of road, and he saw the guy again. The only difference this time, he had ditched the thin top coat, and he was wearing like a silvery white suit. And he just kept on driving because he's like, screw that. I'm not picking up that weirdo again. So he just kept on driving, especially with your wife in the car.
Yeah. Yeah. How do you explain that you had a naked man in the back of your car?
Yeah, I don't want some in the back of your car.
Or you get space cocked.
Yeah, so that's space cocked. That's not from here. Selected UFO Articles, Volume 4 from Preston Dennett. I just wanted to mention a couple of chapters there, really because I had not much else to cover on the show today. But I did want to finish a story that I mentioned a couple of episodes back on a Plus episode from Lon Duquette. I think it was, yeah, a Plus episode. It's called My Life with Spirits, The Adventures of a Modern Magician. This was a great story of Lon, who told basically his life story of getting involved with magic. Remember how he eventually became a practitioner of Aleister Crowley's OTO. And we had that fun story of him going to all that effort to create a magical wand. You know, spending like 24 months focusing his energy on it, doing this crazy ritual where water entities started attacking him and his entire street flooded. And then he accidentally put it on a chair and sat on it and it snapped. And it was a really fun book. And we didn't have time to mention this story from it, which I thought, again, is kind of loosely Halloween connected.
Okay.
Mostly because it's a horrible story full of horrible things. So, yeah, the book is My Life with Spirits. I'll link to it in the show notes, but you can go back to that Plus episode, which we'll link to as well, to listen to the full coverage of it. But I wanted to get to this one I missed. It was The Exorcism of Garkon. And he said early in 1980, he now had this position as a lab technician. Because remember, we were telling the story of how he basically did this ritual to that demonic horse entity to fix his life, and it ended up getting him a bunch of really nice jobs. He's working in this medical device lab, and the phone rings, and his secretary says, pick up, it's Dr. Rigardi, and he wants to speak to Bishop Duquette. Now, Lon had been made a bishop within his, you know, occult practice, and this person on the phone, Israel, was his hero, this true magical adept. He was Aleister Crowley's secretary and student in the 1920s. And when we were talking on the Plus show, I got up to this part and I was like, is that Aleister Crowley's assistant from the desert?
Oh, that's right. But then we came to the realization that it wasn't.
It wasn't, no. He didn't get rogered by Crowley in the desert. But he later went on to rend the veil of the Golden Dawn. He revealed some of their secret initiations and ceremonies.
And so he got kicked out.
Well, yeah, I mean, he was still widely regarded and Lon was good friends with him. So he takes this call and immediately Israel's like, I was wondering if you could do me a bit of a favor. I need a bishop. And as I'm sure you know, it takes a bishop to order an exorcism. And Lon's like, ha ha, good joke, buddy. Yeah. How many exorcisms should I put you down for? Like, you need an exorcism? He thought he was joking. He's like, I'm not joking, boy. It turns out a psychiatrist friend of his was treating a patient who was convinced that she needed a formal exorcism. Now, the woman was knowledgeable enough to know that classic exorcisms must be performed under the direct auspices of a bishop with legitimate apostolic lineage, of which Lon was. I mean, he was, in the occult sense with the OTO, he was a bishop. So before Lon has a chance to kind of back out of this, Israel starts going into the name and number of this Dr. Kaufman in Long Beach, saying, here's the details, make sure you give her a call. And before Lon hangs up, he's like, hang on a second, you're a bishop. Why aren't you organizing this? And he just goes, I just did, my boy. Tell me how it goes, and hangs up the phone. So he basically corners him into doing an exorcism. He didn't want to do it himself, so he called up Lon to organize it. So a few minutes later, he calls this Dr. Kaufman. She's a pleasant-sounding woman. She's very serious about scheduling this exorcism. And she makes it very clear she doesn't believe in demons or spirits or anything like that. She thinks they're just psychological metaphors. But she's familiar with these kinds of things and their potential in modern therapy. It's like if you go through a ritual, yeah, it always helps the patient. And she was being very candid about this. She said the subject was this 38-year-old woman named Sharon. Now, it's quite a sad story. Her husband had recently committed suicide, and she was left with three children who were 11 was the youngest, 16 was the oldest. Now, this Dr. Kaufman starts going into this patient's details, and it sounds like she's desperate to resolve this. And it's quite dark. She says when Sharon was 2 years old, her stepfather started sexually molesting her on a regular basis. And early on in this monstrous cycle of abuse, Sharon created a make-believe guardian, a friendly dragon named Garkon, who came and delivered her to happy places while her little body was being violated.
Oh, that's dreadful.
So she created some kind of tulpa to take her away, some kind of protector in her mind. Now, this Garkon entity helped her survive. And for years, this double life kept her relatively sane. And as she grew older, things changed. Her champion's character began to change. Shortly after she started school and started noticing boys, Garkon's rescues were spiked with random acts of cruelty. There would be a sharp nip on the tummy or an ill-tempered scratch on her face. It actually started to attack her.
Yeah, so like most tulpic entities, it's almost like they start to turn on the creator.
Ironically, she felt that she deserved these little punishments and suffered them gladly. For without question, her fantasy life with this entity Garkon was preferable to the nightly visitations from her stepfather, obviously. Yeah. Now, the years of abuse ended finally when she was 14 years old. Her stepfather killed himself with a 10-gauge shotgun, and she would no longer need Garkon to rescue her. And Garkon was almost a reminder of everything she wanted to forget, of this horrible trauma and how she was treated. But Garkon didn't go. He didn't leave. He didn't go away.
Well, I mean, when you create a tulpa, obviously to even get one to manifest, you have to put a huge amount of mental energy. When you combine that with trauma, it seems to be, you know, a multiplier effect.
Yeah.
Like it would be.
Well, the next night, he appeared in Sharon's bedroom. And he was...
She could see him.
Yeah, he was now enormous. And she could see him in the past. Like he was a dragon type character. But now all his kind of friendly countenance, because he was like a, you know, Puff the Magic Dragon kind of character before. Now that was all gone. He looked vicious. He looked dangerous, you know, really kind of horrifying. And he boasted that he had eaten her stepfather's head and vowed that no man would ever touch her again. Now, Lon's listening to this from the psychologist on the phone, the psychiatrist, and Dr. Kaufman's like, look, these dynamics are pretty simple. This entity, or what she calls this entity, torments her cruelly whenever any factor of sexuality enters her life equation. So she still continued with her life. She ended up getting married in her junior year of college. But because she could never enjoy lovemaking without arousing the wrath of this Garkon entity, obviously the marriage was predictably unhappy, never went well. And the ordeal of conceiving and bearing children was excruciating. And after the birth of her third child, she and her husband basically ended their sexual relationship altogether. You know, didn't touch each other for 10 years. And it was for 10 years that Garkon wasn't seen. He basically slumbered. Now, this truce was apparently shattered when Sharon's husband committed suicide. Now, it wasn't related, this is what the psychologist says, to this Garkon thing. It was due to a business failure, apparently.
I have to wonder, though, don't you?
Well, yeah, exactly. That's what I was thinking. Well, all these old issues from her childhood resurfaced, including Garkon, obviously. And this time, she reached out for help. She sought psychological counseling. Now, this act of reaching out enraged Garkon, enraged this entity who...
Because it threatens its existence.
Exactly. And yeah, that's exactly what she says. It was... Its very existence was threatened, and it started escalating its attacks, basically making her life unbearable. And she started to contemplate suicide as well. And interestingly, this was an idea that the entity endorsed. It encouraged her to do it.
I wonder why. Is it somehow permanently maybe, then bonded with her?
Maybe it'll be free. It's like the genie in the lamp. Like once it's free, it's, it can go wherever it wants.
But if she quashes it, then it dies.
Yeah, well, maybe if she dies as well, then there's no chance for her to destroy it because she's the creator.
She's the only person who can destroy it.
Perhaps, yeah. So Dr. Kaufman, again, who just thinks this is all psychological.
Well, you do wonder that because you go, well, I mean, obviously, you know, childhood sexual abuse is some of the most egregious things that can possibly happen. I mean, it's right up there being the worst thing that can happen. There would be severe, you know, traumas and, you know, manifestations of it, which could be something like this. It's all within the mind. It's the mind's way of dealing with it.
Well, she wanted to resist drug therapy. She didn't want to go down that route.
Yeah.
And she wanted to explore this exorcism as like a psychodramatic exercise to see if it actually helped. Now, Lon's listening to this and he's like, I didn't know what to say. Like the story was compelling. This Dr. Kaufman seemed really anxious and, you know, I appreciated the psychological significance of this possession. But this was serious stuff. Now he starts to think for a moment. He's like, hey, I need help with this. Who can help me? And immediately the answer came to him and he just said, look, I know who can do it if he'll agree. And when do you want this done? She's like, tonight. I need it done tonight at my home in Long Beach. So he's like, all right. He knows this guy. His name's Nathan Sanders. He's another OTO, you know, Crowley's group. He's another practitioner and experienced, the most experienced goetic magician he'd ever met. Apparently, he could summon anything into his triangular black mirror. And he had control of 72 spirits of the Goetia. He said,
"Oh, that was right. That was the sigils, wasn't it?"
Yeah, he said, "I had seen him conjure visible appearance of angels, elementals, and even historical and fictional characters. He was an extraordinary magician. If anyone could take care of this Garkon entity, it was my friend Nathan." So he calls Nathan. Nathan's like, "Yep, let's do it." And off they go to Long Beach. They go and meet Dr. Kaufman. She leads them into the kitchen, he says. They introduce them to Sharon. Now, she looks sick, like her complexion is pasty. She's wearing dark glasses to hide the dark circles under her eyes. Now, she thanks them for coming. And Nathan immediately says, look, I'd like to ask you a few questions. And Lon's surprised by how kind of rude some of the questions are. He basically asks her straight up if she's addicted to fantasy literature. And she smiles and says, yeah, I actually am. How did you know? Which is an interesting thing because...
Has she been feeding it somehow?
Exactly. It's like, is delving into, you know, an overdose, too much fantasy literature, giving enough energy to this entity to stay alive? Like it's of the same world. It's of that same universe.
Yeah.
So maybe that's doing it. And then he basically asks details about Garkon's appearance, his shape, his color. Did his color change, his fingers, his toes, his eyes, all of that stuff. And then asked her how to spell Garkon's name. And on his notepad, he carefully inscribes the letters of Garkon's name in Hebrew and tells her that knowing the name of the spirit is the key to controlling the spirit. Now he starts to run through this checklist of items to make sure everything's ready. Is the phone off? Are the doors locked? Are the pets outside? Does anyone need to pee? When he's totally satisfied that they're ready to go, he lights two candles in Sharon's hands, turns out all the lights, And there's a more to this. Like, they set up a circle to begin this ceremony, and they unwrap a tiny cake of hotel soap and draw a large version of Garkon's sigil in the center of the black mirror they've set up, which is this little kind of thing in the middle of the circle. And when they do it, Sharon's like, like something's starting to squeeze her throat. And Lon's like, holy crap, this is for real. Like, she's actually
having
reacting
a physical reaction.
And Nathan starts doing all these consecration ceremonies. He tells Sharon to relax and gaze at her reflection in the mirror in the triangle and starts to do this invocation. He's like basically summoning this spirit, this dragon spirit of Garkon, saying, I invocate and conjure thee, O spirit. I do strongly command thee, all this kind of stuff. And he starts going into bizarre, unintelligible names, and he's, you know, sing-songing through these goetic names and basically doing all these invocations. And he's drawing these sigils in the air above Sharon's head. And as he's doing this, getting louder and louder and louder, she's whimpering and she's swelling. She starts to swell up, like her cheeks go red and start to swell. Her head almost looks like it's getting visibly bigger. He sees as her fingers start to balloon. It's like she's been stung by bees or something.
She's having an anaphylactic shock or reaction.
Something going on. And he's doing all this, you know, Sharon starts thrashing from side to side. And Lon's like, she's full of shit. She's faking.
She's faking.
And then he stops the conjuration and shouts at Sharon, is Garkon in the triangle? And she's like, yes, he's always been there. And as soon as Lon hears this, he's like, oh, crap, she's not actually acting. He feels the hair on his head spring to attention. The atmosphere in the room seems to collapse. There's all this malice in the room. He can feel it. It's tangible. And he's actually petrified. Sharon drops her hands forward. All this hot wax goes all over this poor woman's carpet. And he kind of holds her hands back up for her. And that's when he noticed that she is actually fully swollen. Like, her wrists are blown up as well. He said her arms were as hard as rock. Like, there was no softness to her. And he took a quick glance at her face. And her cheeks were so puffed up that her eyes were actually swollen shut now. Like, it was bizarre. Now, Nathan continues and he starts addressing this spirit. He welcomes Garkon and actually praises him for all his service. For when Sharon was a little girl and protecting her. But now he says his actions are hurting her. Now, as soon as he does this, Sharon starts going, no, no, don't do it. Don't destroy him. No. She basically can't let go. And Nathan starts shouting at her, look into the triangle. Is Garkon in the triangle? Tell me what he's saying. And she's like, he's laughing at you. She's going crazy now. It became clear that this Garkon entity couldn't be drawn into a dialogue. The spirit's only response was to create terror and then feed on that terror. And he was doing a good job of it. Like, they looked over at Sharon and she's bobbing up and down like a caged monkey. She's gawking open mouth at the triangle. She's terrified. She's swollen into a balloon. And each time they try and get control of this Garkon entity, it doesn't work until finally Nathan's like, okay, we're going to have to destroy it. And the process of destroying it is he does this kind of tetragrammaton.
What is that?
He does this. It's like a conjuring. He conjures up some immortal entity and basically binds Garkon into the bottomless abyss, like sends him to the 27th level of hell or something, empties all this holy water over Sharon's head, rips the parchment talisman of Garkon's sigil, which is around her neck, and burns it in this woman's apartment, like lights it on fire, throws it up in the air, and they claim that it just went and just like burst into nothing. And that was it. That was enough to seal it away and destroy it.
Imagine, though, having to exorcise a tulpa. It's a bizarre story. But you know, when you think of an exorcism, you always think of it being like a demonic kind of creature. But in a way, that itself had become almost demonic. From human thought.
Well, this is what we always say, is that these stories, perhaps not this one, but they demonstrate that thoughts are real tangible things.
Yes.
They don't just vanish and evaporate. If there's enough energy and emotion and will behind them, they form something.
They become autonomous.
They form something real with mind. They form something alive. And this one got out of control. But he said, that's it. It's all gone. You'll never be this embarrassed again. And thank you for not throwing up on my robe.
Too bad about all the wax on the floor.
Well, she laughs and she starts to go and basically shrink back down, like the swelling goes away. The entire ceremony took a little less than an hour. And Dr. Kaufman eventually said, yeah, during the ceremony, I saw it. Like she was blown up like a blimp and said that that's something I forgot to tell you, that for years, her joints swell dramatically during these attacks from this entity. That's one of the main physical things that occur. And that actual physical manifestation was why this psychologist was attracted to the case in the first place. So 2 weeks later, he hears back from Dr. Kaufman and she's like, it was great. It was an absolute success. Garcon seems to be out of her life. She's making progress with her therapy. Everything's going great. So he then calls Israel Rigardi, the other practitioner that told him about this case. And he said, look, we've been praised to high heaven by the psychologist and everything worked out. But this guy was like cautionary. He said, look, the law of conservation of energy applies to magic as well as physics. Our friend may not have been destroyed. He may have just moved along to the nearest center of least resistance.
Which means?
Goodbye, my boy. Hangs up. And he's like, what did he mean by that? The center of least resistance? The Garcon might not be destroyed? Oh, crap.
You're screwed.
Yeah, 2 years later. Good luck, my boy. Hangs up. 2 years later. This is 2 years to the month after Sharon's exorcism. He gets a call. And it's Dr. Kaufman again. And she wants to know if he and Nathan would be willing to help Sharon. And he's like, oh, no, not again. Garcon again. She's like, no, actually, we haven't seen anything of Garcon since the exorcism. Sharon finished her master's degree. She's now a PhD candidate at UCLA. Everything's great. She's doing great. But there's been a family tragedy, she says. Her son, Robert, committed suicide the day before yesterday, and her two daughters are taking it hard. Now, he voices his sadness and he asks Dr. Kaufman to relay his sympathy. And he just basically wants her to get off the phone because he knows that something's coming. Like, he's sad for this situation, but he's like, I don't really know these people. And
yeah, I don't want to get caught up in this.
Yeah. Until finally she's like, Lon, maybe you can give me some advice. He says, oh God, here we go. Alex, Sharon's oldest girl, believes her brother's ghost is having sex with her.
What?
I'm just like, oh God.
What?
This is why I didn't do this story on that Plus episode and why I've had it hidden away. Because it's
so
awful.
So you just throw it into the Halloween special?
It's, I don't know. It's kind of Halloween, isn't it?
Is it?
A bit of ghost incest is Halloween-y. Yeah, so she's convinced her dead brother is having sex with her. And he's like, why did I answer the phone? Why on earth did I answer the phone? Anyway, he goes, go on, tell me the rest of the story. Now, the story was every bit as bizarre and gruesome as Sharon's possession. As Dr. Kaufman unfolded the details, he said, I couldn't help but view the scenario from a magical perspective, and the conclusions I drew made me sick. You see, for nearly their entire lives, Sharon's three children were forced to grow up with a suicidal father and a mother who was perpetually on the brink of madness. And in this unwholesome environment, they had only themselves to turn to for emotional support. And as bright kids, they soon discovered what keys to turn and what buttons to push to exploit their dysfunctional parents. Their father's suicide and their mother's liberation from Garcon changed all of that almost overnight. Sharon now had her life back and was not about to return to the old insane patterns, including allowing herself to be manipulated by three disturbed and very spoiled children. So the two oldest, Robert, who was now 18, and his sister Alex, now 16, acted out their frustration in grand style by publicly flaunting their before heretofore secret incestuous relationship.
Oh my God.
This is a Halloween show. Just to let me just make it more Halloween-y.
What the hell is wrong with you?
Does that make it more Halloween-y? Is that... is this an acceptable story now?
I guess that's better, I suppose.
I guess we should... Oh, shut up, Crow. It always happens. I guess we should keep going.
No, can we just move on to the shitty AI story?
Should we just skip it? So he's having sex with his sister.
Oh.
But they were flaunting it now, so that you can assume the mom's hearing them going at it because they're just trying to get her attention, basically. And everyone knows now, so their reputations are ruined at school. Robert, to get away, he enlists in the Air Force, and Alex, his sister, 16, she plunges headlong into nymphomaniacal promiscuity. After less than a month of basic training, Robert goes AWOL and turns up at home. In one last attempt to bring their mother back into line, he accidentally hangs himself in the garage in what the coroner called a failed mock suicide attempt. What is going on?
So sounds like narcissistic rage or something.
He tried to, so I'll show you, Mom. But he actually did it. Accidentally.
Yeah.
So for the 2 days and nights since her brother's death, Alex, his sister, had been violently masturbating in her room, smothered as she moaned in Robert's embraces, her brother's embraces. I think this is Halloween because it's kind of horrible and disturbing. This is what Halloween should be. It should be all horrible and disturbing.
It's definitely horrible and disturbing, that's for sure.
So he calls Nathan. Remember about 2 years ago, we did that Garcon thing? Yeah, it's way worse now. I need your help.
Is it implying somehow that this Garcon entity has come back and caused all this? Is that...
Yeah, I think that's what he's saying. Like, it's created... Well, just the energy of it. Like, the negative energy
has gone to
the children.
Look, as horrible as it is, it actually... It kind of lines up with other stories you hear of, like, the idea of intergenerational abuse and the idea that this can somehow travel down. And there's this idea that perhaps you can genetically cause injuries to future offspring with trauma, right? Mm-hmm. But then also, it's not just the genetic idea, it's actually the spiritual idea that somehow you do generate these entities that follow families around and they continue this horror that keeps on going. And that's exactly what this is. I mean, it's true horror.
Yeah. Well, they go into the house and they check everything out. They take a psychic along with them as well. And basically the psyche is convinced, yes, the spirit of the dead brother hasn't gone anywhere. He's still in the house. And so, yeah, the sister is probably correct in what she's claiming, that she's being attacked. It's like it's a incubus now.
Yes.
It's basically sexually attacking her at night. And they do this ritual. It's a very simple thing. They do this kind of banishing and cleansing ritual. But what they do with her is they tie one end of a length of string around a portrait of her dead brother, and then the other end is around her waist. And then they give her a pair of scissors and they get her to cut the string.
Right, okay, so symbolic.
Now, it sounds very simple, but it was very difficult for her to do it. Like, very, very hard for her to do it. And it is symbolic, but it's a ritual. It has great meaning. And this seems to break the connection. And Sharon thanks them and vows that she's going to get rid of everything in the garage because she had everything left there from his deed. But he said, as we shook hands, I realized that my friend Israel Rigardi was right. Garcon had just moved along to the nearest center of least resistance. He said, I didn't want to know where the law of conservation of energy would send him from here. And that's where he left it. He was convinced that it was never truly gone. It had just morphed into something else. And even getting rid of this horrible situation after the suicide of the young man, it hadn't completely squashed it.
No, it never does. I mean, you hear this stuff about, especially about OTO, but those rituals, those practices... it's like what happened with Crowley. I mean, he allegedly unleashed the Loch Ness monster. Mm-hmm. You know, you never squash this thing. Once you open the door, once you allow them to come through, there's really no way to get them to go back.
So Let's move on to some spooky AI stories after that train wreck that was your free show on this episode. Let's make it. So I use wordplay.ai and I typed in various things. I typed in my first time with a succubus. You can just give the story a title and it'll generate 1,000 words. So I'll read you a little bit of what we got from this one. I love the crow because I can't find the cat anymore.
Oh, that's a shame.
The crow's the best one. My girlfriend told me to stop talking to the man on the phone and come to bed. I didn't want to give up so easily, but I had a feeling it would be best for me and my relationship with my girlfriend if I did not.
You can tell it's AI.
Hang on a second. So you're on the phone with another man and your girlfriend thinks it'll be good for the relationship for you to come to bed and get off the phone with the other man, but you think it'll be good for the relationship if you stay on the phone with another man. So then it says, so I put down my book, went into my room and got into bed and started to cry. The next morning, I woke up early in order to find out what happened that night. Was she really pregnant? Was there really a ghost demon in our apartment? Or was it all just a nightmare? To find out what happened that night, I needed to talk with my girlfriend again. After our conversation, we both agreed that we wanted this experience again and decided that when our daughter turns 12 months old, we could get her a new mummy. The end.
Do you know what, though? That story actually sounds more coherent than some of those old sites that have those sorts of stories.
I love it how at the start we're saying, AI, like you can't even tell the difference. It's so eloquent and human-like. And we just read this.
It's just as retarded as what a lot of humans are.
Monstrosity. So I created another one. The haunted honky-tonk piano.
Oh, here we go.
That took my virginity. And you just type in the title and it creates it. So I need some spookiness. The idea of playing the piano might not sound all that sexy, but it can be a great way to test your seduction skills. As cliche as it sounds, many men have their first time with a woman played out on a piano. Okay. And a few experiences have been more romantic than the one I had at the haunted honky-tonk in Meriwether Post Estate in Columbia, Maryland. It was December, and my first break of the semester from college was coming up quickly. I just transferred from Georgetown University to their top-notch fine arts program and had high hopes for my future beyond small-town Maryland. The piano bar was located just around the corner from my school, so every day after rehearsal I would make a beeline for the place in hopes that my professor would be there. There was no guarantee, of course, but I had to try. Then one evening as I sauntered up to the bar and ordered a shot of tequila, I spotted her, my professor, sitting on one of the red velvet chairs at a table with a group of students chatting over drinks. She wasn't entirely familiar with my department as she had just transferred from City University of New York, or CNUY. Cunny, where they didn't offer music classes like we did at Georgetown. We chatted for a while about college life and how crazy it was with music classes until she eventually asked me what piece I was practicing. I told her I was working on Mozart's Haunted Honky Tonk and proceeded to tell her about some of its more romantic moments before launching into a passionate rendition of the last few minutes of the work. I was lost in playing when suddenly everything went black. My vision blurred for a few seconds before returning to normal with something huge and dark looming over me. A man in blackface wearing an oversized suit who was sitting at the piano bench across from me playing Mozart's The Haunted Honky Tonk. That's the end.
Oh my God. I mean, if this is what the future is, if this is what AI holds for us, I don't want any part of it. Like, any part of it at all.
I thought it was pretty scary that there's a guy in blackface looming over him while you're playing the honky-tonk piano. Look, okay.
How many Kindle Unlimited books are being published using AI?
Admittedly, the AI needs some work.
Some?
Yeah, admittedly, it's not as seamless as we first advertised at the start of the show. But it's worth throwing in there. I'll link to that. That's wordplay.ai. You can find that. It's actually A lot of these are free to use, but...
I bet you there'll be paid services, though.
Yeah, the more you use, like if you use over 5,000 words, you've got to start paying for it. And it's pretty expensive. It's like $100 a month for a lot of these services. I'll link to Preston Dennett's book, Not From Here, Selected UFO Articles, Volume 4, along with the excellent Don Duquette's My Life with Spirits, The Adventures of a Modern Magician. I hope you enjoyed the sweet Halloween stories.
Oh, Ben, it was fabulous.
Yeah, one of
it
the best shows
just, I think so.
I think we've ever done. Absolutely. Easily top three.
I don't know how it's going to beat our Plus extension coming up. Because we're going to be going into some definitely non-Halloween style stories.
Are you going to follow through with some of our best content ever?
No, I'm not. I'm going to go down a very, very different path. Actually, I'm kind of excited about this Plus extension because I ended up picking up an old story. I was going through an old APRO bulletin. And this is where some of the best stuff really is, when you go back into the really old things. And I pulled out this 1978 article that actually covered... a ranch. It was this weird phenomenon that occurred at a ranch that is called the Clearview Ranch. And it actually ties in with a really, really well-known experience that you and I love, Ben. The story about the Bigfoot being electrocuted by this weird box.
Oh, yes.
Right? So there's something to this story which is a little bit different. It suggests that there's some type of extraterrestrial / interdimensional war that was occurring at this location, and those boxes had a very, very different purpose to what I imagined. So that will all be explored and revealed in the Plus extension coming up right after this.
Someone on Twitter actually asked a couple of weeks ago if we could generate a image of that Sasquatch being blasted by that box, and a bunch of them came through. So now I can finally use one of those as the cover.
All right.
The cover to this show.
Is it good enough to put it on a t-shirt?
Well, nothing about this show is good enough to put on a t-shirt. So we'll see how we go. That's a wrap for this free edition of MU. Happy Halloween, everyone. Sign up for MU Plus. Mysteriousuniverse.org/plus for all the details. You get extra extensions to our exceptionally good shows, which are usually so much better than this one. So much better than this one. Look, if this is your first time listening to this podcast, just start again. Go back to another one.
Yeah.
Go back to the back catalog. Or sign up today at mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. You get access to the big extensions we do every single week. And Plus members get an entirely exclusive show that comes out on Tuesdays. And if you sign up for MU Max, you get access to our entire back catalog. Over 10 years worth of shows in there. Plus members also get a higher quality MP3 of the show, so better sound quality and a totally ad-free version of the show as well. That's a wrap for this free edition of MU. Happy Halloween. If you're on Plus, stick around for the great stuff after the break. For everyone else, we'll catch you next week.